We're changing what it means to interact with other humans in society, and we're doing it by running a real-time experiment on billions of people. I want to suggest that that's a really bad idea. We wouldn't do that with the vaccine. We wouldn't do that with a GMO food, but we're doing it with AI.
Day by day, the machines are gaining ground upon us. We are becoming more subservient to them. More men are daily bound down as slaves to tend them. More men are daily devoting the energies of their whole lives to the development of mechanical life. The upshot is simply a question of time, but the time will come when the machines will hold the real supremacy over the world and its inhabitants. Samuel Butler wrote those words in 1863, the year of the Emancipation Proclamation, in which he foresaw a world in which man would be enslaved by machine. The somewhat satirical essay calls for the total destruction of all machines to save humanity from inevitable subservience to them. Starting with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, science fiction writing often fixates upon the fear that machines will surpass us, replace us, and even enslave us. Terminator, Mass Effect, The Matrix, and Blade Runner all deal with this existential fear. Now that artificial intelligence has arrived en masse through ChatGPT and Gemini, regulators around the globe are rushing to regulate this technology to prevent its abuse while still enabling innovation. The EU has jumped out ahead in trying to regulate artificial intelligence and is hoping that its regulatory power will help set global standards for AI use. But will it? To discuss this complex and serious topic, we invited the brightest and best. Ian Bremmer, founder and president of the Eurasia Group, and Anu Bradford, professor of law at Columbia University and author of The Brussels Effect and Digital Empire, The Global Battle to Regulate Technology. This episode was made in available in full, no Patreon whatsoever, but if you would like to join our Patreon and contribute to future episodes such as this and to hear the full-length version of other episodes, you can subscribe today for as little as €5, pounds, or dollars per month. As always, please rate and review Uncommon Decency on whatever platform you use, and send us your comments or questions either on Twitter at UndecencyPod or by email at UndecencyPod@gmail.com. One final advertisement from me. Have you ever wanted to step into the shoes of a politician? Perhaps you think Michel Barnier wasn't harsh enough on the UK, or you think David Frost doesn't know what he's doing. Well, now's your chance to right the wrongs of the Brexit negotiations by playing the game How to Win Brexit. We are giving away two copies to our Patreon members who will be randomly selected. So if you haven't signed up, here's yet another reason for you to become a Patreon member today. This introduction was written by human, not artificial intelligence. Thank you, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, and welcome to this very exciting episode we have planned on possibly the most talked about topic in international affairs, domestic affairs, technology, and that is, of course, artificial intelligence. So I want to start by laying the groundwork about, you know, what is artificial intelligence? Why should we regulate it? And what sort of timeline should we be working on in terms of regulation? I want to start with you, Anu, because you've written about the Brussels effect in terms of regulation, and the EU has made that a priority. So if you could start by laying the groundwork for why we should be regulating AI and what sort of timeline we need to be working on.
So I think the hardest thing about talking about AI governance is that it is the kind of technology that has just tremendous upside. And we need to be really careful that we do not forgo all those gains and opportunities that there are to make societies more productive and harness the benefits of technology. But at the same time, it is a technology that comes with many risks, that pose risks to fundamental rights of individuals, to democratic structures of the society. And we can talk about short-term, long-term risk. We can talk about existential risks and the risks that may not be existential, but still at the same time, very severe. So that has now created what I would say a global conversation of the need to regulate artificial intelligence. And as we expected, the European Union has been one of the front runners in this regulatory race.
Look, I'm an enthusiast. when it comes to AI. I'm very excited about the technology. I think it presages a new wave of globalization and unlocking human capital around the world and in very short order. So I don't mean to sound in any way like I think we need to shut down this technology, but it's also very clear that this technology is moving a lot faster than governance. And I'm delighted that governance are now taking it seriously. They're prioritizing it, but the challenges are still going to be very, very significant. And companies are highly incentivized to look at the profit that comes from this AI technology. They are not incented to take accountability for all of the negative externalities that will come. That's where regulations are required. And we have a long way to go before we start addressing those problems.
Ian, you wrote an article on this very issue in Foreign Affairs. I want to go to the next step. Practically, what does regulating AI look like? What would those regulations be? Who would be implementing them, both in the writing, but also in the implementation? Are we talking about states? Are we talking about companies? In your article, you want to recognize AI creators as geopolitical actors in some way. Could you explain what this means in practice?
Well, I mean, what it means in practice is that I would much rather have governments do the regulating. I suspect Anu feels the same way, right? Because they actually have experience. They've got the people, they've got the background, they have the mechanisms, and they have more alignment and incentives to do so. But I think that practically speaking, a lot of the de facto governance of AI is being done by the companies. I mean, these companies are the ones that are building the models. They have the business plans. They're the ones that are developing the algorithms. They're the ones raising the money. And a lot of how AI interacts with society and with our global economy and with our national security is in reality being driven by a very small number of individuals who run these companies. So that when I say that technology companies are becoming geopolitical actors, that's what I mean. And I fear that the best we are going to be able to do for governance in this space will be a hybrid model where the technology companies are working with the governments and they don't get a veto, but they are a core part of ensuring a level of compliance of how the rules are written, all of those things, because the alternative to that is likely, in my view, not to be governments in charge, but will be companies controlling everything, as we have found with far less consequence, but certainly serious consequence in the social media space.
Yes, I completely agree with Ian that there is no way that you can expect the governments to have all the knowledge and all the resources to regulate effectively without engaging the actual developers of technology. But the tech companies are also using this as an advantage in the conversation to say that, look, we have the knowledge, we are the ones in the position to self-regulate, and they are downplaying the expertise of the government. And I think we all know that the governments don't necessarily have the adequate know-how around this technology. But at the same time, I mean, that to me is not a compelling argument to write off the role of the governments here. Governments are regulating many domains in which they are not experts. They don't know how to build airplanes, yet we're all comfortable that we are regulating airline safety. The same when it comes to medicine, comes to vaccines. We want those domains to be regulated by the governments. And I think it's also really important to remember that AI is not just a technology. What is also at stake is how the technology implicates democracy, how it affects fundamental rights. And the tech companies are not the experts on those issues. So I fully agree with Ian that it needs to be a hybrid model of a sort, but it needs to be a hybrid model with a clear hierarchy that ultimately it is the governments, and in my view, ideally democratic governments, that provide the democratic governance foundation for this technology.
When we think about AI regulation, and I was at a conversation with US Senators Mark Warner and Todd Young, who were talking about artificial intelligence and regulating it, Do you think we need to look at a wholesale approach to the technology, or are there specific areas in which it is applied that we need to focus on? And when I say a specific area, you mentioned, for instance, democracy. So, for example, the use of artificial intelligence in election campaigns would be one specific area where we could focus on immediately. Which sort of approach do you think we need?
I mean, I definitely would say it needs, this is not one size fits all. You know, for example, I was recently talking to the Norwegian prime minister, who I like a lot, and they've just put a law in place that no smartphones in schools anywhere in the country. That's it. I strongly support that. And I worry about what AI will do as it applies to young people. Algorithmic thinking, disintermediating our kids from other children, from social engagement. I mean, we all, the EU AI Act and the US executive order, there's a lot of focus in ensuring that there is testing of these large language models to ensure that they cannot be used in ways that are harmful, in ways that they're not meant to be used. So, for example, to develop weapons. And we can all agree, we don't want AI to be able to, you know, be used to develop a new horrible virus or a new kind of weapon. We can all agree on that. But we don't yet have regulations that say that we need to test these AI models on small groups of people to understand the social implications of these AIs on how we develop as human beings. And yet it strikes me that that's an essential thing to do. It doesn't happen to be aligned with the business models of these companies, but it's very important. I mean, for me, the thing that I'm actually most worried about, it's not the robots taking over. It's not displacement of jobs. It's not the building of new weapons. Those things are all true. The thing I'm most worried about is how AI will change human beings. Change our behaviors, our social behaviors, our civic behaviors. And, you know, in a very short order, you're going to have AI that is not trained on global data, but that is trained on our data individually. So in other words, Anu's AI will be different than mine, will be different from yours, Julian. And that means that we will have a tool that will be with us all the time. And we can use it as a hybrid human being. That has a means a lot in terms of functional inequality in our willingness and ability to engage with people that aren't so hybridized. And also, we're going to have all sorts of AI beings that are virtual that, for all intents and purposes, will feel to us like human beings. But they won't be human beings, and they shouldn't have rights like human beings. We are changing what it means to be a human. We're changing what it means to interact with other humans in society, and we're doing it by running a real-time experiment on billions of people. I want to suggest that that's a really bad idea. We wouldn't do that with a vaccine. We wouldn't do that with a GMO food, but we're doing it with AI. And if there's one place that I could wave a wand and say, I want governments focused on this because the companies by themselves won't do it, that's the area I want to see it happen.
Let's pivot to Brussels a little bit. Essentially, I think for technological base, but also the commercial development of AI is largely at the moment in Chinese and American hands. The EU is further behind on those fronts, but it still wants to play a major role in regulating AI. There was an agreement reached on the 2nd of February between the member states in the EU on the Artificial Intelligence Act. Anu, maybe could you walk us through what we know of this agreement at the moment?
So we are really at the final stages of this ambitious legislative effort. So we have every reason to expect that we will get the vote in the European Parliament, which will be then the final step, and the AI Act will be binding law by the end of this year. But it still takes a while for it to be effective and imposing the obligations on companies. But it is a law that I think will fund fundamentally shape the development of the AI. It has provisions that are binding. It has provisions, the breach of which will lead to consequences that are non-trivial. It carries high fines. It prohibits altogether certain AI applications from being offered in the European Union. And it sets then a series of obligations for other AI applications that don't reach the point that they are prohibited, but that are still considered to pose a high risk, and that then require the developers and deployers of AI to undertake several measures to ensure that the safety of those applications is guaranteed. So this is, I think, an important moment for the EU, but it's also a very important moment for global conversation about the AI, because the EU can pave the way and show to other governments that are currently considering various similar legislative measures that this can be done, AI can be governed, and it's done by one of the credible governments that has significant experience already in setting rules for technology.
Anu, we owe to you the concept of the Brussels effect. And famously, the one example that we always bring up is the example of GDPR, the capacity of the European Union, despite not having those huge technological empires like the US or China manage to shape the conversation, complete change of market. Ian, maybe, is this a pipe dream, or can Brussels have a Brussels effect on the issue of AI, or is it a bridge too far given the technological gap?
I mean, I think they will have an effect. And I say that in part because the EU remains the world's largest common market. And when they put regulations in place, companies that want access to that market, even if the regulations aren't fully fleshed out, will pay attention and they'll start to align to it early because they understand the costs of not doing so. So it is, to the extent that the Europeans have a superpower, the regulatory superpower is that. But let's keep in mind that this is a completely undergoverned space. It is changing at light speed. I mean, three times faster than Moore's Law in terms of the rollout of new AI models. And people in the EU regulatory space and the US regulatory space don't actually really know what they're dealing with. So I would if you made me make a bet, I'd say the Europeans are going to get it more right than others in terms of understanding where it's coming. But my bet is that nobody does. Nobody gets it right. And that we're probably going to have to see some major crises and before we have effective governance. And then the governance will respond to the areas where the crises happen to hit. And everything that we're doing now is preparing the ground for that. But that's very different from saying, oh, we're going to create a regulatory framework that will determine how this is going to be governed in 5 years' time. I don't think that's happening.
Yeah, so I think the EU is probably better placed than any other jurisdiction to regulate AI, in part because AI is an amplifier of many of the existing issues that we have in the digital space. So AI can amplify the market dominance of these companies, and the EU already has a robust framework in place to deal with various competition concerns. The same way AI can amplify existing problems with disinformation, and the EU has its Digital Services Act. So it is already in the position to tackle content moderation better than many of its counterparts. AI and the harnessing of the data to develop these AI models entails issues around data privacy. And again, there, the EU has a regulatory infrastructure in place. But I fully agree with Ian that this is not an easy technology to regulate. This is a space that is so fast moving that the EU, even with all its experience and conviction and competence, will have a hard time to do this well. But I do think that this is one of those moments when you need to conclude that, look, you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We are still better off with the EU's imperfect AI Act in place, even if it's not perfectly enforced. It does reset the expectations. It will constrain some of the AI practices, but no, it will not be perfect. And no, it alone will not be enough.
I guess what I'm trying to argue is that there is a qualitative difference here, which is so great that it becomes quantitative. In other words, I mean, the EU has been by far ahead of other parts of the world in terms of climate regulation. But we've had decades And I mean, the great thing about climate, right, in terms of figuring out a regulatory framework, it's global. It confirms your priors over time. Every year it becomes more urgent, but it's also comparatively slow moving. It's got a human scale. I mean, it works incrementally. AI is exponential. And as a consequence, the impact it has on society is discontinuous. It's more akin to figuring out what the global landscape should look like after a world war than it is in response to climate change. And so while I agree with everything Anu just said, I actually believe that on balance, governments will look like they have failed all over the world in 2 to 3 years' time. It will become more urgent. We will need different responses. Again, governments were nowhere 2 years ago, to be fair, right? I mean, this was not being discussed in a serious way by any major global leader 2 years ago. And that means they are way behind the curve because billions and billions of dollars are being spent. And not only is it being spent, but it's being spent without internal political players that are trying to stop it. Usually, when you have a major new technology, there'll be all sorts of very invested, powerful actors that will say, we want to slow this down precisely because we know it's going to hurt us. I mean, think about moving the transition energy and all of the coal producers and everyone that benefited from that saying, okay, we want to stop that from happening, right? But with AI, not only is it this incredibly transformative, fast-moving technology, but literally every corporate actor in every sector of the economy is trying to figure out, how do I use that to make my own company more effective, more productive, measure things better, unlock human capital? So governments are really, really behind the eight ball and late to this party. And I worry about that.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of interesting angles, though, as a response to what Ian said. So one is that it is particularly difficult for democracies that are committed to democratic rulemaking. Those processes are not fast. I think the EU has actually moved remarkably fast, given that it is committed to the various democratic checks along the way. There's commitment to rule of law. So all these issues can be litigated. The democratic governments are dragged into the courts when they are trying to enforce these regulations. So one question is whether China will actually be more effective, because when the Chinese government decides that it is time to crack down on big tech, then it is time to crack down on big tech, and they don't deal with the same kind of constraints around democracy. So I think that's one issue for us to consider. And another one that we haven't really talked about, what poses, I think, an additional layer of challenge, that this is very difficult for the governments in terms of even if they are fully committed to regulating. But all this regulation and conversation around regulation takes place against the backdrop of the geopolitical significance of AI and that the tech war that is unfolding between the US and China. So at the same time when the US government is considering on how to regulate the technology, it cannot go too far because it needs to be mindful that it needs this technology and these companies in its battle against China for technological supremacy, for geopolitical, for military supremacy. So the stakes are particularly high, as Ian said, for the companies, given the profits involved, but it's also the stakes are very high for the governments because they rely on technologies mainly emanating from the private sector that will have military applications that are absolutely crucial for present and future warfare. And I think that also adds just an additional layer of uncertainty in terms of what regulation will emerge.
I mean, I think when we talk about China in particular, right, it's very interesting. The conversation we've had so far really doesn't apply to China, in part because the Chinese government is really the dominant actor in the economy, but also because China, the Communist Party, sees significant components of AI as an existential threat to their political control and security. So, I mean, there was this one, probably the most important public intellectual in China on AI is Kai-Fu Lee, who wrote this book called AI Superpowers. And he basically, his thesis was that China's going to become the dominant actor in AI because they're going to have the most data I mean, they've got, you know, all of these people that are on their smartphones. They all use super apps. They don't have any privacy. And so data is going to drive AI, which makes sense, except for the fact that the Chinese government is deeply uncomfortable with the idea that their people should have unfettered access to bots, right? Because they'll start using it in ways that the Chinese government can't control. So it's at least plausible. Never mind the fact that the Chinese have been cut off from having high-end semiconductors, and it may take them 5 to 10 years to catch up to the Americans. Leaving that aside, it may be that given the nature of the political system, China will succeed in controlling AI, but will therefore not be a credible global competitor in this space. That is thoroughly possible in the way we think about this going forward.
So I completely agree, Ian, that AI in many ways, it is a double-edged sword for a government that is interested in social control. Because as you say, AI can undermine that. You need to teach these bots not only how to speak, but how not to speak, and so that they do not wander off from the line of the Communist Party. But if you then think about one other dimension, AI and facial recognition, surveillance technologies, then AI is an enabler of authoritarian control. Yep. And there is tremendous demand in China for these technologies. There's tremendous supply of these technologies. And that's one subset of AI where the Chinese government is leading. And it is leading internally, but also if you think about the demand for these technologies in many other authoritarian countries around the world. And China is a main exporter of surveillance technologies and expanding then its digital authoritarian model along the digital Silk Road. So that is, I think, one sort of additional way to think about the role of authoritarianism and AI as a technology.
So I agree with that. And what we need to ask ourselves, right? I mean, if the communication revolution was threatening to a country like China and all authoritarian states because it democratized information, accessed information, and then the data and the surveillance revolution was actually empowering to China and to certain multinational quasi-monopoly platforms, but problematic for democracies, to what extent does AI reflect a decentralizing as opposed to a centralizing technology? Now, there are components of AI, as you mentioned, Anu, that are clearly centralizing. And that those are the technologies that are helping to increase the real-time surveillance and sophistication of those tools. I would argue, at least as we see it right now, that the most important component of AI is unlocking human capital. It is taking individuals that heretofore had access to information and then have access to publish the information, now have access to intelligence, have access to world-class healthcare and programming capabilities and education and you name it. And if it turns out that I'm right about that, if the fundamental driver of AI productivity comes from the latter camp as opposed to the former, then I think China's in real trouble, right? But I agree that what we're looking at right now is early stage and impressionistic, given how fast this technology is advancing.
I want to ask about specific commercial actors and their reaction to regulation. We often see countries try to do a race to the bottom in regulations in order to attract companies coming to their jurisdictions. Do you think we'll see something similar with AI, or will the commercial market applications and the access to large commercial markets, such as the European Union, deter from that sort of flight away from, for example, missile signing a deal with Microsoft very recently? Do you think we'll see more companies, say in Europe or in China, looking to relocate to jurisdictions with a more lax approach to regulation?
So I certainly understand the logic that we need to consider that that is a possibility, but there is a reputational cost that is non-trivial. If you are trying to evade regulation, there's a very public, transparent conversation. Every move of these companies is followed, it's reported, it's discussed. And for these companies operating in the space where there is a considerable consumer concern around the safety of these technologies. It can actually be beneficial for them to say that, look, we operate gladly in jurisdictions where there are some guardrails because we are committed to those guardrails. I think it is a harder thing to explain to say that, look, we do want to evade regulations that are widely perceived to be in public interest in order to take advantage of loopholes, in order to participate in the race to the bottom. So there is, I think, also a sort of argument to the contrary, to say that these companies just cannot afford, especially when you were mentioning the big companies, the Microsofts of the world, their reputation is intertwined with the public perception of their commitment to safety. So I think it is not that easy strategy for them to follow. But at the same time, we also need to be mindful that there are bad actors. There are actors that may be less visible, whose reputation is not part of the public conversation, and who will be taking advantage when they have access to these technologies of finding a way how they can potentially evade the constraints of this regulation.
Yeah, it's early. I mean, you know, I see a big argument coming down the pike about open source versus closed source for these models. And the companies are beating each other up because they have vested interests in one as opposed to the other. And they will use those interests to try to nudge the regulatory conversation. But I think it's too early to say. I suspect the technology is going to determine which wins, not the governments. The nature of the technology and which ends up being more scalable and more effective. So, I mean, if you wanted me to give you percentages, right, I think that at this phase, I'd say 80% of the governance in 3 years' time is going to be determined by things we don't know yet about the development of the technology. 15% will be determined by the nature of the business model of the companies that happen to win as a consequence of both the technology, the entrepreneurs they have, the availability of capital, you know, the right product and fit. I mean, some intangibles. And then 5% will be what the governments are doing, which is obviously not the conversation that we are generally having right now. Right. And I don't mean between the three of us. I think we are actually trying to have that conversation. But if you go to, you know, the big summits that have taken place so far, they have mostly acted as if the governments are going to be the ones determining this. And by the way, the companies are very happy to have the conversations go that way. They want to abdicate that responsibility and accountability. They're like, not it, you know? And the other thing they want to do, of course, is they want to focus on challenges that need to be regulated that don't touch their business model. Because I mean, look at the hand, right? This is why so many of these corporate titans want to talk about the existential risks of what happens if the robots take over. Why? Because that allows governments to busy themselves with something that isn't going to affect their EBITDA. And we should not be distracted away from the things that are problematic to their business model. This is why social media has worked so hard to destroy democracy, is because they're really good at distracting you from those challenges, because they're core to the business model of those companies.
My closing question for you both, obviously this is a topic that has come onto the radar quite recently for non-technologists and programmers or people working for these companies. What is a book recommendation, and Anu, feel free to plug your own work on digital regulation, what is a book recommendation you have for our listeners about how they can learn more about artificial intelligence and the coming challenges?
So this is actually what I'm expecting the books next year to be about. I think there will be just a wave of books around AI. And it's probably hard to pick one that is different. The reason I wrote Digital Empires is that I couldn't find the book that really brought all of this together, that really thought about AI alongside other key technologies. Think about the regulation in the US, in China, in the EU, and what are the major battles when those regulations and those different frameworks and governance systems collide. So there was, to me, a market for that conversation. But alongside, I read many tremendously helpful books. Guy Fuli's book is great to understand the thinking about AI and China. I think Suleiman's Wave book is also a great one on how technology evolves. There's a great book coming out in a couple of months by Angela Chang on the High Wire, so how China regulates the platform economy, governs the technology sector. So there's a lot of books that I would recommend on this one. But I'm also very curious to hear what Ian is reading on AI right now.
So when I started working on AI, which was only about 3 or 4 years ago, it was in part because of my friendship with Mustafa Suleiman. And I realized that there was an entire world out there that was very likely to affect geopolitics that I did not yet understand. And I didn't have the tools. And this was the first time I've tackled a major issue where I knew from day one I wasn't going to be able to do it unless I had a co-author. And so, you know, his book, The Coming Wave, that just came out a few months ago, I think is an essential read on this issue for people that are out there right now. But I want to go back for a second. I mentioned that, you know, for me, what's interesting about AI and the reason that I'm so skeptical that governments are going to do an adequate job in the near term to respond to it is because this reflects exponential change in a way that affects governments. And we've never had that problem before. We've had all sorts of incremental change. We've had discontinuities with wars and revolutions and pandemics, but we've not had fundamental exponential change in something that's core to the way that entire society works for a period of time. And the first person that really wrote about that in a way that is systemic is Ray Kurzweil. And the book there that really changed the way I thought about how technology can affect the world is The Age of Spiritual Machines. Mm. And this was a book that he wrote, I want to say it was back in 1995-ish. And it was not a global politics book. It was a bit of a technology book, but it was really a society book. And it was one that sort of took Moore's Law for semiconductors, which had already been going on for decades at that point, and applied it to everything. And if the fascinating thing about that is you go back and you read that book from 1995, and here we are 30 years later, and you go, my God, this guy really understood where the world was heading. And it's that kind of outside the box, force yourselves to get uncomfortable with where we might be in 10 years' time. In 20 years' time, because government leaders right now are very limited in their imagination because they're older, because they don't deal with these technologies, they don't understand them, but also because they live in short-term incentive environments. And we need books that force us to think outside of that frame. And I would argue that Kurzweil, who is still with us, thankfully, that was his big seminal book. He's done other things since then, which I don't find quite as compelling, but that book is an absolute must read.
Thank you so much, Anu. Thank you so much, Ian. May I plug another book if we're talking about AI? It's actually a fiction book about a post-AI society. It's Dune by Frank Herbert, which imagines a world after artificial intelligence. That's another good one on this topic.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Thank you so much for both of you for coming on for a fascinating conversation. To all of our listeners, we'll see you in a second in the outro. But Anu, thank you very much. Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good stuff. Yeah.
Welcome to the outro portion of this episode on artificial intelligence. Francois, I know you've been very excited about this one for a while, and thank you for putting it together. Really, really fascinating discussion with Ian Bremmer and Anu Bradford. So thank you to both of them for joining us to talk about artificial intelligence at a very, very high demand and high interest period in time in this critical technology. Francois, I just want to start with you. What were your main takeaways from our conversation today?
Yeah, it's interesting. When you get new technology, there is always a temptation to say, oh, we've seen this before. This is like the printing press, you know. But every time it's a new technology, someone will say, this is completely new. There is no blueprint for this issue. We're going to have to invent something completely new. So there's always a tension between both of these things going on. And, you know, I think we saw that today as well. There are definitely kind of elements of our history we are trying to attach ourselves to. You know, are we talking about, you know, I know Ian is talking about kind of techno-prudential board that would be helping to regulate artificial intelligence. Obviously, when we talk about new technology like that with a potentially destructive impact, people talk about nuclear weapons over time. So it's really interesting to see how people are trying to find an approach to cover this new issue, and given that the technology is moving so quickly. And I also remember reading the, we talked about this book a few times, a book by Kai Fu Lee, AI Superpower. I remember reading that book and was really impressed, and actually a little worried, you know, oh, so far behind on China and rest of it. But in the end, you know, this was a very smart book, a very well-argued book, and a very informed book. But at the same time, a lot of its predictions about China's dominance on AI didn't come to, well, no, China is still a dominant power, but America stepped up, invested a lot of money, and now you've got many top, not just on the research side, but on the commercial side of companies are in America. So again, you know, I think it's a conversation where we need to be quite humble, accept that we will make mistakes, that we will probably always be a few steps behind, but that shouldn't stop us from, you know, trying to regulate those issues, given how important they are, and given that, you know, they are exponential and can be very transformative.
Yeah, I think, you know, speaking of the book recommendations, the one that Ian suggested at the end, The Age of Spiritual Machines by Ray Kurzweil, or I should say Professor Ray Kurzweil, it brought to mind, and spoiler alert for the video game Mass Effect, if you haven't played it, please just pause this episode right now, go off and play Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3, and then come back. At the end of Mass Effect 3, you are presented with a choice of either destroying all the machines in the universe, destroying all living creatures in the universe, or synthesizing man and machine, or just letting a cycle of perpetual destruction continue. And the main argument of the book is that it is impossible for, you know, humanity will inevitably create machines, it will create artificial intelligence, and that artificial intelligence will inevitably exceed living capacity to think and act. And the end result is inevitable conflict, and synthesis is the only sort of peaceful solution. Every other one involves outright destruction. So apologies for ruining Mass Effect for everyone there. But one thing that sort of really stood out from this talk today was the immediate focus on the core elements of what it means to be human. And, you know, we talked about elections, and Ian talked about education specifically, and the fact that artificial intelligence, if you have your AI assistant in the palm of your hand that is unique to you, it will start to change the way you think, and you will start to think like the machine and not like a human. Mark Andreessen, who is a big AI evangelist and is obviously invested in a lot of AI companies, he likes to say that in the future, AI will be your best friend, it will be your most patient teacher, and he's very excited about this fact. Others think this is ridiculous and terrifying, and we shouldn't allow AI within 50 feet of children. I don't know where you fall on that particular one. Are you an optimist or a pessimist about AI's applications to our society?
So actually, we wrote a report last year in my think tank, Onward, which was quite bullish on the commercial applications of AI. But I have to say the kind of human nature aspect concerns me. You're right about the kind of personal assistant. May I bring another point, which is, I think it's related. I think our relationship to democracy, I think will change, because that's an idea I've been thinking about a lot recently. If all of a sudden there is an answer to all of your problems in your pocket through this kind of wise machine, I think it will encourage a form of thinking which will be kind of very technocratic and incapable of accepting that a democracy is not, there isn't, you know, a science of government. There isn't always one right policy. There's often quite an arbitrage of different values and different interests that you have to take into account. My concern is that we are entering an age, to quote a French philosopher, where we'll be going away from the government of people to the administration of things. So I think that's my concern. And we are seeing this nowadays. You know, there is always a kind of technocratic, aristocratic maybe temptation of, you know, there is a right solution, but, you know, because of populists, because the people wasn't well informed, we have to appeal to them, and what we need is kind of a strong, enlightened ruler which will kind of overrule those petty personal interests and push for the common good. as defined as something which is obviously self-evident. So that's one aspect I'm really interested in. And but I think more generally, there's an issue, maybe not an issue, but the question of artificial intelligence has not been politicized yet domestically. It's an issue where people still don't know enough about to have kind of an informed political stance on. But I think that's a shame. I think the moment we start politicizing the issue of artificial intelligence, we'll be spending a lot more time thinking about it, thinking about the consequences. You know, there will be one day a kind of left-wing and maybe a right-wing opinion of what our artificial intelligence policy should look like. And I think actually we should be welcoming that kind of conflict, because I think it's through that conflict that we will be thinking a step further about AI and you know, with the process of democracy, with the back and forth of democracy, we will end up more often than not finding a adequate solution.
Yeah, the pessimism about our ability to regulate an exponentially growing technology is one that I do share in some degree. But I also find, perhaps I'm a human optimist in the sense that we have consistently found ways to adapt to technologies. And I understand that artificial intelligence is potential across the spectrum, not just of commercial, political, technological, but also philosophical and spiritual. Changes that it will make is unlike anything we have seen before. But oftentimes we find the emergence of new technologies and ideas to be unparalleled or unprecedented in history. And in some ways, though, we've been grappling with this question for, you know, over a century and a half, starting with Samuel Butler. In Era One or Over the Range or his Darwin and the Machines essay. You referenced Dune, which of course has a Butlerian jihad in it. That sort of element of the fact that in many ways machines have been the oldest enemy in all fictional universes. They're the most consistent enemy that we face in fictional universes because there's something intrinsic to it that we as human beings reject. And the fact that that has been such a constant throughout time gives me hope that people recognize the risks and the threats on an individual and a societal level, and that we might even rise to the challenge of regulating.
Two things. Previous technologies we've adjusted to, but there have been kind of great moment of revolution and crisis following them. I talked about kind of tongue-in-cheek early on about the printing press, but you know, let's not ignore the impact the printing press had at the time. Without the printing press, you don't get Martin Luther, you don't get the Reformation, and you don't get probably the 30-year war following that. Without the emergence of social media, you probably don't get the Arab Spring as well. We had an episode on wokeism with Yasha Munk and Pierre Valentin. I don't think you probably have, you know, the woke movement without social media. So my question is, and it's a completely open question, what will be the kind of religious and the political implications of artificial intelligence? What will be the kind of great crisis moments, the great revolutions, the great profits that will emerge following that? I think that's going to be really interesting.
Well, I mean, Ray Kurzweil has, you can tell how much this book influenced me. He was once asked, is there a God? And his response was, not yet.
Okay, well, on this rather ominous tone, let's finish on this. As a reminder, you can join us on our Patreon section. There was no Patreon section this week because this was an important episode and we wanted all of you to be able to access to it. However, for most of our episodes, you'll get a sizable portion of that conversation, which is only for Patreon supporters. You can support the show for as little as €5 a month. Reminder to everyone, you can also join us on our Patreon and you'll be able to win a copy of Brexit, How to Win It. So reminder, you can sign up. We'll be distributing a copy randomly to one of our followers. So feel free to join us there. And as usual, you can share the podcast on whatever platform you're using. You please rate and review it. It really makes a difference. Thank you so much to you, Gillian, and thank you so much to both of our guests, Ian and Anu. Their books should be below in the description if you want to take a look. Really excited, and I think we're taking a bit of a break, and we'll see you after Easter. Bye, everyone.